out into this wilderness to find. Leaving our country, kindred, our father's houses. For what? For the kingdom of God. Let us pray.
All right, welcome to the Literary Hangover. I'm Matt. With me, Alex Guns.
Hello.
And making his first appearance, Chris. Are we doing the last name, Chris?
Sure, yeah.
Chris Liao.
Hello.
You might remember Chris from Informationer episodes, if some of you have tracked some of those down, which still sort of lives on, which might make a bit of a resurgence. Now it exists as Infower, which Chris runs. Chris, do you want to tell us about that right off the bat?
Yeah, it's a weekly newsletter, comes out on Sundays. It's, a great digest of what happened through the week that wasn't covered wall-to-wall, you know, on television or social media necessarily.
It's also sort of our WhatsApp chat throughout the week put into, like, better formatting, basically.
Yeah, that was the genesis, right? It was just we were already spending so much of the week processing news and, like, giving our two cents on it. And, so often it's not a narrative that's, you know, reflected or heard enough, you know.
And the audience we're sort of going for is, like, if you have somebody who is, maybe Trump pushed them into being more political, and they're like, where do I get the news? And they're like, well, I'm trying to do my best. I'm watching Rachel Maddow. It's like, that's not it. Don't watch television.
Yeah, if television is involved, that's, yeah.
So Infower, how do you sign up for that?
You can go to our Facebook page, the Informationer, facebook.com/Informationer, and there'll be links there. We post all the links. We're also on Twitter at Infower, @Infower_. And there'll be links to sign up there.
And I'll put it in I guess I can just put that in the show notes, too. The Witch. You've seen The Witch.
I have seen The Witch.
What did you think about it?
I love the way it looked. They, like, pulled dialogue from actual, like, court cases and things like that, which is to attempt some level of authenticity. Great. I had an issue with the story. I don't know if I've heard it's, like, a classic now, but I don't understand the dramatic. I'm going to spoil it. Is that okay, Chris? Mm-hmm. I'm going to spoil it. I don't understand. I'm ready for someone to, like, dissuade me of this opinion. But 80% of this movie is about, like, the dad going crazy, right? And, like, thinking the devil is everywhere and trying to, like, stop the devil from taking over his house. And your understanding is like, oh, that's unfortunate that he's going to kill his own family members. Mm-hmm. But the end twist of that movie is that the devil is, one, real, and two, taking over this woman. So all his actions were totally justified in the beginning of the movie.
Uh-huh.
It undercuts its own premise, I think. I just don't think it's as... It tries to, like, cut it both ways without synthesizing those two ideas and ends up leaving you with, like, two halves of different movies.
Yeah, well, that does seem to be the thing with horror movies now, is you play out the tension. It used to be, like, how long can they keep the monster? I guess this is sort of the similar concept, right? Do you keep the monster off screen or not?
Yeah.
And then... once it's on screen, what happens then? And and sort of playing with the tension of, are they crazy? Because you could have the monster on screen, but have them be crazy, right?
Yeah.
So there's this thing where it's like, yeah, we're going to dance around them being crazy versus them being justified. And you don't know if, because this is a movie environment where supernatural shit could exist, you don't know which is which until the end. And it does seem, yeah, they just decided, well, we're gonna err on the side of, oh, the devil, it was real.
Yeah. And this guy was right to, like, want to, like, expel people from his own cottage or, like, his own daughter. He's like, you got to get out of here because you're with the devil. And that seems like, well, that's absurd. But then you find out at the end, like, well, it's good that he did that. And he should have done more, essentially.
Yeah, you should be more vigilant against your pretty daughters.
Yeah.
But I actually had forgotten a lot of that plot until you just reminded me of it. What I liked about it was the sort of just the setting and tone of it.
Yeah.
Because, it is very brim. And that brings us to one of our, the book we're talking about today, which is The Barbarous Years, The Peopling of British North America, The Conflict of Civilizations, 1600 to 1675, by Bernard Baylin. Have you read any Bernard Baylin?
I had never heard of him until we read this, and I remember looking on Goodreads or something that he doesn't have a lot of published works besides this, that this was his, like, magnum opus.
I think that's wrong, though.
But I think he's got two Pulitzers, right?
Yeah, it's weird.
Oh, does he?
Well, that's what's...
Wait, am I wrong about
You're actually
something?
Wrong about that. Well, it's strange, because you're right, I had not heard of it.
Same.
I had not heard
the
of it.
The first part was right, and I just took it too far.
But, well, you relied on Goodreads, which, since it's...
It's been debunked.
It's a Jeff Bezos property now, which means it's fake news. let me see here. Yeah, he's an old Harvard professor, longtime historian dude.
Oh, okay.
And here's how the Charles Mann review in the New York Times starts. In theory, Bernard Baylin, I think is how it's pronounced. In theory, Bernard Baylin should need no introduction. In actuality, the intellectual landscape is so fragmented that highly literate Americans may not know of this prolific Harvard historian, the recipient of two Pulitzers, a National Book Award, a National Humanities Medal, and a Bancroft, the most important prize for American historians. Yeah, I didn't, man. I had never heard of him.
Same.
No.
I came across him referenced in Maya Jansenoff. Talk. She's the one who did the recent book about Joseph Conrad. But that was, and that was after I'd listened to this book. But that was, she was the only other time I'd come across him, I guess. And I didn't know he was that prolific, I guess.
How did this book come on to your...
Yeah.
This book, I was looking for just source material for this time period on Audible. And this is, you know, 1600s. I wanted something, you know, I do want to read those, 1492. I think that is Charles Mann.
Yeah.
I want to read that. Those are good too, but
1491 and 1493.
Yeah. But because, literary hangover sort of starts in the turn of the 1600s. Like that's when a lot of the early settlements start happening shortly after. He looks like he's co-author and editor, and he's done a lot of stuff. So did you read the Alan Taylor review?
Yes.
What did you think of that? Because I didn't know where Baylin was coming from, I knew the publisher and his sort of background were generally establishment, but Academic Press is, it's funny that a lot of the conversations do revolve around things like sex, gender, race, and capital.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a grain, that's the grain of truth that creates a Jordan Peterson freak out about, like the university system. Right.
Right.
So you can still get that from these establishment type people, right? They're going to leave certain things out, but what they leave in is enough to, is actually pretty good. But so I wasn't that Alan Taylor calls him, or basically identifies him as sort of this, in this lineage of American exceptionalist writers, and I should read what this actually says, because Taylor wrote his review in 2013 after the Republican primaries, where Gingrich, I guess, was really going into it. That Gingrich also was a Space Force guy.
Yeah, he wanted a moon colony.
God.
Yeah. That was like that when it was like Romney was on top, and then there would always be one candidate who would go to number two and then go down, and then Newt. Each person had like 3 weeks.
Right.
It was like a monster of the week, and at the time would have been Newt, I guess.
Yeah. Here's what Alan Taylor says about Baylin. Never so crass as Newt. Baylin subscribes instead to the scholarly variant of exceptionalism that describes a process of historical development. In the colonial beginning, traditional Europeans sailed westward, determined to replicate the hierarchical institutions and late medieval values of their origins. But they encountered a strange and wild land of menace, challenge, and opportunity. Pitted on the frontier against Indians, the newcomers struggled to master a fertile and abundant land. By conquering and prospering, their children and grandchildren became tough individualists tough individualists endowed with a new set of American values. Rejecting deference to authority and tradition, they competed to get ahead of one another by acquiring private property. So he says Byelin subscribes to this, but in I guess more complicated ways. And what did you make of that?
Well, I mean, it was definitely a different reading from what I got from the book. Mm. But I understood where he was coming from, but I don't think that the author has a lens of exceptionalism, but more of like a lens of amoral, that this is power butting up against each other in a very violent and chaotic way. And then whatever emerges from that chaos becomes like a European order, which essentially is what happened here. Like my initial reading of this was like essentially disgust. Mm. And I think that the author wisely outlines like brutality really well.
Right.
I think, you know, to Alan Taylor's review, he was surprisingly harsh. And he was fair. He had some high praise for him in his work too, but when he cut, he really cut deep, and especially toward the end of his review. But he, I feel like there was a bit of like an overcorrection, maybe, like you're coming from, on a relative basis, like you're trying to correct for this mythologized beginning of America. Like everyone knows there was genocide, you know, with Indians. I would hope everyone knows that, but there's still sort of like this mythology around the founding of America, and he was trying to be extra real about that.
Yeah, I feel like what happened, and listeners of this podcast will know I'm a big Alan Taylor stan. He's been referenced, I think two of his books have been played in a couple of the episodes Alex and I did earlier. I think, but this review is in the New Republic. He's got a hook in there, a topical hook, Gingrich, American Exceptionalism. I think that it's accurate critique in the sense that, in a specific sense of how narrow it is, right? He talks about you're getting British North America. It's sort of keeping constant the group of characters that we had during the time of American Exceptionalism. Right, like these are with the Puritans, the Chesapeake Bay people, Dutch New York, and that's a very sort of, I guess you wouldn't call it the Virginians Yankees, but you know, like that's sort of that's the cast we know from the myths of American exceptionalism, and we've come to a time in history where you can't really entertain that realistically, as like those myths have been so shattered at this point that Bernard Byelin doesn't even talk about a Thanksgiving in the Barbarous right. Years, but he still has the exact same cast of characters. It hasn't widened to, you know, a focus more on like frankly, Alan Taylor, I think, is a wrote a better history of these times. It's just less focused, but his American colonies, it talks more about the disparate groups and not so much about the people who were, you know, legislating at the time, right?
Yeah, like you get the sense that the characters in the historical characters in this book are steeped in the politics of Europe, which you essentially can't escape, but there's a new politics and a new relationship that's being born in the new world that I think other authors might cover better, whereas like you the context that Bernard is looking for is like religious and economic relationships with the European powers at this time. Mm-hmm. So I could see how it's like, if you're going that route, you're going to go into like, you have a very limited amount of narratives because it has to play into like the Civil War in England, or it has to play into like religious toleration in the Dutch Republic and things like that.
Right. Did you have anything from the book you wanted to cover off the bat?
I think that that's just like a guide, signpost for later. The New Amsterdam colony is really interesting to me. Mm. And
had you heard of the Vanderdonk guy?
Yes.
You had.
I just had read a book earlier called Island at the Center of the World.
Okay, yeah. This is mentioned on the Wikipedia, actually.
Yeah, that's a much more narrative approach, like bordering on it maybe should have just been like a fiction novel. Because, you know, it's like Vanderdonk like looked out into the water and thought about, you know, whatever, religious liberty or whatever the fuck. just because also that we live in this area is, I find it the most fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah, it was interesting to hear about, talk about just peopling the area, you know, if we think chronologically. We're talking about going through the streets of London and just rounding people up, like as young as 4 years old. You know, vagrants, quote unquote, or just poor people, you know, young people, and throw you in jail or send you to another continent. And then you become an indentured servant for someone for some fixed period of time.
Yeah, would that be under Cromwell?
Yeah,
this was before Cromwell. Yeah, maybe during too,
or like around that time.
I think this was like before that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and like there was like specific orphanages that were funnels into the New World, right? So it's like they would pick these kids up off the street, and they'd be like, "Oh, if you want to like get them out of here, basically as like a pest control almost. It was like just send them out." Which was news to me. I had never read that before.
Throughout the whole country. It was like,
yeah.
Think about Australia, right? Like, oh, where do we send these people in prison? Where do we send, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it was like moments like that that the book outlined so brilliantly for me. Like the baseness and wickedness and violence that it took to eventually form a country that we're currently in.
Yeah.
That it's like, it's the bedrock proposition of this country is destruction and rebuilding, and that includes people in that process.
Right. Yeah, England was nuts, man.
Yeah. I'm
pretty fucked up over there.
To think from their perspective, right? They just, like, threw all these, you know, from their perspective, vagrants or poor people, and then, like, much larger than them, we, like, bail them out in World War II.
Well, it's like I have another book I want to brag about here. I've already Instagrammed this one. Regeneration Through Violence, The Mythology of the American Frontier, 1600 to 1860.
I don't have the quote, but essentially that the Barbarous Years posits that the like race language and race science is still kind of new at this time. It's not as hard and fast as it would be in the 19th century, but they were already having imperial problems with the Irish at this time, and they're able to just pluck up that language and those racial stereotypes and connotations for the Irish and just easily transplant them to the Native American. So all of a sudden they're lazy and also like inherently violent at any moment and like want to destroy the nuclear family and things like that. You know, stuff that we hear today.
Yeah, exactly.
about our chosen enemy of the state.
Hmm. So here's what Slotkin writes in Regeneration Through Violence on the Puritans and Cromwell. The pressure of demographic expansion coupled with the psychological fear of acculturation moved the Puritans toward a policy of exterminating the Indians or, at best, reducing them in a semi-captive status on strictly and narrowly delimited reservations, called at that time praying towns.
God.
Damn, I love those sorts of details. Like that is a Slotkin. First of all, he's my favorite writer right now. I've been just listening to the audiobooks I made of his book, like back and forth. He says the best parentheticals. It is interesting to note the adoption of similar policies by Puritans colonizing in Ulster and on the Celtic border of Scotland, where systematic assaults were made on Celtic tribesmen, native bardic myth historians were forbidden to sing, isolated clans were exterminated, and the rest of the population was ravaged. Cromwell even attempted to establish a, quote, wild Irish reservation in Western Ireland. His brutal conquest of Ireland seems to have been conceived, in part at least, as an English equivalent to Spanish jihads against the Indians, which Cromwell had read about in a book dedicated to him by the nephew of John Milton. His wholesale slaughter of the Irish and his selling of many into West Indian slavery parallels exactly the policy adopted by the American Puritans in King Philip's War 2 decades later. That the situation of the New Englanders, whose opponents were racially and religiously more alien to them than the Catholic Irish were to the English Protestants, evoked similar attitudes and policies is not at all surprising, given the character of their ambitions and their religious and cultural convictions.
Yeah, and you can see at this moment that the weaponization of the cracking in Christendom, because now they have like a hard, provable difference between like the Irish and the English, which is like the English celebrate Anglicanism, you know, which is the highest form of what of celebrating God, and the Irish have held on to Catholicism. So there's all of a sudden it's like, well, you can, that's the reason you can remove them from their own land and create like a Puritan ruling class, which is still playing out actually today.
Israel, ways, Palestine?
Like, well, like Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, although the Northern Ireland now sucks economically.
Yeah. What is it? Just Belfast, basically?
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah.
I probably shouldn't have just said Northern Ireland sucks economically. Trying to be a little bit more careful about just making blanket statements about different countries. Yeah.
Well, what's its status in the EU with Brexit? That's what my question is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I meant to say. They're at a crossroads.
You know, it was interesting in the Alan Taylor had a line when he was talking about, you know, the early settlers coming over to America. And he talked about, I wish I had the actual quote, but when he talks about coming for their soul. Well before 1607, the Chesapeake natives learned many unpleasant truths about the Europeans who came across the Atlantic in sailing ships to steal their bodies, their lands, and their souls. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's genocide is one thing, stealing all their land is another thing, but I mean, it just sounds particularly evil. I mean, really, I mean, if you think about the conversion of Christianity, right, they're coming to for their souls.
Right.
I mean, that's just so...
Well, you know, it makes me think of is there is this bubble. We live in probably one of the more informed, most, like, your bubble can be popped by unpleasant information here, right? But it's still a sort of bubble where when we talk about things like foreign policy, we're not really talking about it with people that approach, say, Islam as a grand religious clash of civilizations, right? Like, we all discuss it as if, like, yeah, we need to approach these things not as if Muslims are our like, existential and, you know, metaphysical enemy. But there are a lot of people that approach these things in that those exact ways. And that was pretty much everybody back then. And that is one of the hard things for me to wrap my head around.
Well, at this time also, I mean, this time is like a broad sense, but the European mind and the English mind had finally found a way to intellectualize their way around moral disasters. Like, is it John Locke's thing about the state of nature, which is like barbarous, short, and cruel? Right. Yep.
Sounds like Locke.
Yeah, so as soon as they walk into the New World, they're like, oh, this place is barbarous. Like, we need to act this way. When in reality, they're bringing the barbarism with them. Like, they're bringing that ideology to a place that has essentially had found, like, equilibrium. And you can just, like, they're like, how do we find a way to continue to be brutal? It's like, oh, we'll codify it, essentially.
Right.
It becomes an ideology that can be spread. Oh, yeah.
So much of that philosophy from those time periods was really, like, self-justificatory wanking.
Yeah.
With, like, very good classical learning behind it.
Basically. We have to question any philosophy that's like, no, the people in power are good.
Well, they had an interesting stat, too, about coming in, right? We viewed it as high-minded. We're coming to modernize these people. But in the book, they had a stat that the starvation rates amongst the Indian tribes were below what they were in the urban European cities.
Oh,
the
yeah.
Time. You know, and there's probably some sort of, you know, switch to, you know, from an agricultural society or something in there. I don't know, but
right.
It was a pretty interesting statistic.
Well, it reminds me of my favorite, the Massachusetts Bay Colony logo here, which has a Native American holding a bow and arrow, and then a thought or a word banner coming out of its mouth saying, come over and help us. But it's also interesting to me that you always need to have that sort of framing, right? It's like, it's never, let's go get those natives and take their shit.
Well, yeah, you're not invading Iraq. You're helping.
You're doing them a favor.
Yeah, and because you need to bring so many actually religious people. I imagine some people were cynical about this shit, even at the time, right?
Yeah, I would assume most people in power, essentially, were cynical about it.
But you need to have the, like, everyday believer type people on. Like, the people that believe that in The Witch 2015, it's actually a devil the entire time.
Yeah.
You need those people on board.
And the people you're sending across the ocean to probably die, or some of their family members are going to die.
To
go out there, it's going to be fine.
To maybe, like, harvest 80, like, husks of corn over a dozen years and then starve to death.
The good life.
Yeah. Okay, I don't want to get ahead of myself here.
That's why you would have that propaganda campaign, right, with the Indians saying, come and help us. So you don't want to advertise, oh, there's a bunch of hostile Indians out there that want to kill you. You know, if you manage to survive the trip and don't die of starvation, Indians might kill you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're going to be away from everything you know and love, and you'll probably die very quickly in, like, some horrible climate where there's, like, no housing. But the idea is, like, actually, we're going to give you a higher purpose than you may have ever experienced here.
Yeah, okay. That reminds me of the other thing I wanted to talk about here with respect to, you know, because of the focus of this book is so dark, and it's on the horrible parts of settlement, which is fine. That's what appealed to me about the book. It still appeals to me.
When I told someone I was coming to do a book review on this, on the early settlers and colonization of America, they were like, oh, like the real history, or like the, you know, the mythological history. It was just like a...
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The real shit, the dark shit.
This sort of living, like as depicted in The Witch 2015, where you literally are like a bad harvest away from eating your boots to avoid from starving to death,
mm-hmm.
or cannibalism actual. There's not a religious idea that I reacted to more negatively when I was younger than Calvinism and predestination specifically. Like growing up as an American.
Yeah.
You're going to fucking tell me that I don't get to decide if I get to go to heaven or not? Like, go fuck yourself. I honestly think that, even though that's not, like, part of the Catholic Church thing, like, it made me less... Like, I just can't handle that.
Well, we'll have to get... When we get to Marilynne Robinson in, like, 5 years, she's got a pretty good defense of Calvinism as compared to other Christian religions, because she's like, listen, like, predetermination is like baked into the cake with this thing. If you have an all-knowing, all-seeing God, like, we're just being, because she's a Calvinist, she's
right,
like, we're just being frank about it.
Well, what I was gonna say is, if you live at this time, it makes a lot more sense, right? Because you don't get to, like, theorize about works or grace. You see that your sister, who was a very nice girl, got eaten by a fucking bear, right? And she was praying. She was more of a devout person than you were, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, you have been a devout man your entire life, and all of a sudden you don't have food, and your two kids starved to death over the winter. Like, right? Like, Calvinism makes a lot of sense in that perspective, right? Because what the fuck can you do? It's complete, like, learned helplessness. Yeah. Just do your duty sort of thing.
Yeah, they had it. They had a stat where they said 15-30% of the male immigrants to Maryland died within the first seasoning year of residency by the mid-century of the 17th century. 30% infant mortality rate, and 40% of the population died by 20.
Yeah, and this is something that I think really shows up in generational... like, this is sort of like Scarlet Letter happens two or three generations past this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when there's trade and there's, you don't have to worry about, like, just dying or getting killed by, like, Native Americans, right? Like, it's a completely different mindset. But the idea that you would mythologize that time and try to take lessons from those times apart from like the actual good lesson, which is only nefarious because and pernicious because it's obscure genocide. But like the Thanksgiving myth, right? Like that is ideally that's a communitarian myth. Like we should all work together. Now, when you widen open the frame a little bit, then you start to see the bigger problems. But we can start to play a few clips from this.
But I think at that time, it's at least from our reading, that this world is much more alive for people like Hawthorne and like the Founding Fathers than it is for us today. Like, I think they may not, they didn't pick up on the moral lessons of it, but I feel like that psychic trauma is there for them. Like, the idea that Hawthorne would want to address this moment in Salem history because it was, like, he was obsessed with it, not out of interest, but out of, like, some sort of, like emotional longing. I feel like you can see this world that they talk about imprinted on that generation much more than I would have thought before, I think.
I think it's got to be similar to the way we look at the sort of Industrial Revolution through World War II time period.
Yeah.
Right? Like all the labor stuff, all the capital stuff, and all the paths that you could have taken and promise that it might have had. Well, I guess promise would be a different discussion because there's not, like, it is just, I bet their understanding of it wasn't far from, as far as from Balin's. I bet they didn't look back fondly on this stuff, though, don't you think?
Yeah, I think I would imagine they had roughly, like, they didn't have, like, you know, the data, but they had the basic outline of what happened. They knew people who were there, essentially. Like,
right.
It's not within living memory, but it's not too far beyond that. They just didn't, maybe they weren't as, like, they weren't on the same moral page that we might be now, but we don't even know it. Like, people talk about, like, the history and the real history, but I feel like I read a good amount of history books, and I still don't know, you know, compared to, like, literally any other time period in American history. Because I think it's, like, obscured almost. Or it's not us. It's not Americans. It's American colonies or whatever other reason.
And on a scale to now, it's so minuscule, right? Like, we had 118 citizens this year. And then, we can count the trading ships. 50 came this year. We know, mm-hmm. we have a memory for every one of them. Like, it's such a minor scale operation, really.
It was insane the level of detail that he had throughout the book about the statistics. Like, three of them came from this shire within, you know, England or in the eastern town here. And it's like, it was very detailed.
And that's the sort of, you know, benefit of this type of historiography, where it's sort of, when you focus on great men, whether they were governors or whatever, there's always drawbacks to that, but one of the positives is they leave a huge ass paper trail, so you can actually study that shit. Like, that's it's almost natural, because it just creates material for people to reflect upon.
Mm-hmm. But think of that. There's this quote in Jefferson's notes on Virginia. He says, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that his justice cannot sleep forever." Like, that's a quote of, like, a guilty man and someone who knows he's, like, part of a lineage of guilt. Even if he can't necessarily describe it yet, or it's like he's not there emotionally. But, you know, I wonder, to be alive at that time, if they know that it's like this is all ill-gotten, essentially.
I think so.
Or like the learned, the whatever, the Enlightenment class was like, ugh, we might be fucked someday.
I think you look at the way they took steps to conceal certain things.
Yeah.
Like, and mythologize over, like, George Washington basically being, like, the just first realtor of the in chief, right? Like, it's funny that Trump doesn't, like, when he's like, people say there's great presidents, me and George Washington. And it's like, if you even knew how much you had in common with that guy, like.
Or just the astute observation in America, the two great presidents are the first one and the living one. And that's it.
Yeah, exactly. Just a coincidence. Speaking of Washington and those sorts of cohorts, the book talks about this sort of gentry's children, I think, a couple of times as like sort of highly literate, but also wanting to prove themselves and get onto the frontier. And like that's always the weird thing to me is like these were sort of pampered rich boys, but also, you know, they had like horses and armor and swords and shit. But they also read, you know, they're like Roman history bros.
Yeah, you get.
Is that what we're calling Renaissance men now?
Yeah, exactly.
Roman history bros. Fuck.
Right, there's the generational expectation creep.
Oh, you know, yeah.
And like, in Fukuyama's Origins of Political Order, he talks about that, right, where you have one rising class, like the class or the generation that makes the gains, and they're just sort of happy to get there. But then inevitably they're the next generation from them, you know, they're used to that, and now they have this whole new set of expectations, and they're going to want more. And yeah, it was interesting to see that play out here.
I think there's something to be said about, like, the more a person knows about, like, the human story or, like, history, that there's this urge to also just alienate yourself from all of it as well. And, like look at John Winthrop or someone who, by all accounts, a pretty educated person with the exception of his obsession with alchemy. He's the first one to throw that all, like to throw that lineage away and be like, I want to be the progenitor of something else. You know, like I want to alienate myself from previous generations. Which, if there is like an American sentiment, that probably is it. It's like, I'm not part of any lineage. I'm starting over. I start over whenever I want.
And it was sort of the height of the feudal system that enabled them to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Well, so these nonfiction literary hangovers are going to be more casual fare than the fiction ones are. But I feel like we could go to play a couple clips here. First one I want to play is just one that confused me. Chris seems to have be able to imagine it in his mind's eye. but it goes into, you know, the Native Americans and their weapons. Their weaponry. They use bow and arrows. Or bows and arrow. Bow and arrows? Man, I don't even know that.
Just
one.
Say them all and then just pick the right one.
My
for
dad
the edit.
Would be super upset if I didn't know that.
Does he hunt with bow and arrow?
Oh, yeah. He. My dad is in the North Dakota Bow Hunter Hall of Fame. You can look that up. That's true. So this is describing the power of the bow and arrow.
The arrows, 3 feet or more in length, could be shot with great accuracy up to at least 50 yards. Their triangular projectile points, flaked from dense rock to razor sharpness, could tear through the hides of bears or moose, let alone human flesh. They penetrated deeply, were difficult to extract, and were likely to produce hemorrhages. An arrow that killed a Frenchman on Cape Cod in 1606 went through him and pinned his dog to his body. The arrows made by craftsmen.
Okay, what?
The dog went on his body, right? It went through the dog and then pierced the guy as well?
I think he stated it in reverse, that it went through him and then hit the dog, right?
Yeah, he said it went through him. We're going to
like kebab.
Here it is again.
Like if the dog was right behind him.
Ordinary bowmen could hit Cape Cod in 1606, went through him and pinned his dog to his body.
Went through him and pinned his dog to his body. The thing that bothers me about that is that it's an awesome story. And he rushed past it, clearly, because that is not a good enough description of that.
Well, I mean, maybe he had a limited description himself, but he mentioned that the arrows are 3 feet long, you know, and so if the dog is anywhere remotely behind him,
so
you know,
you're
the arrow could
like,
come down and, like, hit him, like, could come, you know, it can hit in the low end of his body and pierce the dog, or if
right.
it hits
and
upper
he sort of falls
end of
onto
his body,
the dog.
It could be a steep angle. Yeah, maybe he was jumping in front of the dog to save the dog, you know, he's...
Because...
That's probably less likely.
That would
but,
be such a great
know.
Narrative.
No! Not my dog.
In my mind, I'm thinking he was holding his dog. Which
just
is
in the
boy.
Heat of battle, just carrying around his dog. His
well,
dog got tired.
Or it's like, yeah, his dog, it was just too hot out. I mean, I've been, I had to walk somebody's dog and used to get really tired and not want to walk after like three blocks. So I'm thinking, I'm putting myself in the shoes there, and you don't know you're getting shot with an arrow. I mean, maybe you do. That's a good shot. If that guy knew he was going to get shot with an arrow, and the Native American shot him and the dog with the same arrow, that is a trick shot.
Yeah, I imagine he'd probably be feeling pretty good.
Yeah. That is, they call it counting coup, sort of kudos in war, Native Americans.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if this specific tribe would do that, but it wouldn't always be super violent things. I mean, it could be you take a scalp live, although it wasn't only or even primarily Native Americans that were doing the scalping. But I think the best one or one of the best things you could do is sneak into their like camp and touch them and then run away. I'm not joking. And they'd freak the shit out of them. And so you'd freak, like, and that scared the fuck out of so many, like, just American soldiers that were like.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be horrifying.
Yeah.
Like, if you're just living in a world of constant warfare and that someone's like, I could have killed you and chose not to.
Well, and remember that, as we know from Hawthorne, every single white person at this point thought of them as the devil kind of too, right?
Yeah.
Like there's something satanic about you and those dances and songs you do. And we need to stop that shit.
It was outside of civilization. Essentially it was like pagan,
which meant scary.
Yeah. 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 I think it was in the first chapter where we did like the author did a pretty good overview of, or a very quick, but I felt good overview of Native American culture. And this real focus on equilibrium, which I found very interesting, that like wars essentially weren't even like turf wars between different Native American tribes, but the idea was to like meet some, like there's something out of balance and needs to be balanced. Almost like it's like Hegelian, only that you're at the final moment, and then like the final moment of the spirit of history is complete. Currently, and it can get out of whack, and you need to put it back in whack, or put it back into balance.
Right. Well, there was the Mystic Massacre and the Pequot War, which is mentioned here, which is the one that was, they like set this village of women and children on fire. The men were, I think, stationed elsewhere for this war, and they couldn't hear screaming or anything. They're outside the village. The way they do this, as far as I understand, were vertical poles straight up around. So it was like a circular surrounding, and they just let it, like, basically burn them all alive.
Mm-hmm. I got an understanding of certain tribes' mindset when they would attack an English colony. It would be not to wipe them out or not to push them out of there. It was like, there's too many of you right now.
Right, and that's what at the Mystic Massacre, which was May 26, 1637, they're like, what are you do? What is this? This isn't what we know as warfare, right? And even the tribes, and this is sort of a coalition of the willing of Captain John Mason and their Narragansett allies, because the Narragansetts were apparently along with them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mainly because the Pequots were the cock of the walk. They had the best, like, I think probably river territory or whatever. Or they were just the strongest. But anyway, even the Narragansetts after that massacre were like, we didn't know this was the game you guys were playing.
Yeah.
This is it was fun when we did it, and but you guys are taking this way too far, which is a characteristic American thing.
So earlier we had talked about they would just grab people from the streets or empty their prisons out. You know, in terms of race relations in the new colonies, you know, they would just send, you know, poor people or whoever. A lot of people were indentured servants, so specific, you know, they were. It didn't matter the race, right? Typically it was fixed years, right? You would work for someone for like, what, 6 years or 5 to 7 years or something like that. And there were all these stipulations and they would vary by contract, but race was sort of secondary to that. But it was interesting to see that how that changed over time. They talk about, you know, after the first wave of people came and they realized how tough the conditions were, less people started coming, less, you know, poor white people even that would be indentured servants. And so once they had less poor white people, you know, to be, you know, basically slaves, that's when they saw this uptick in the black population that they would, you know, and eventually that morphed into chattel slavery, and there weren't fixed you know, time periods that you were contracted to work for. It was your life and all, you know, the length of your child's lives and beyond.
Yeah, I got this really excellent passage on the morphing of that of basically slavery slash indentured servitude into what became known as, like, yeah, if you're a black person, you're going to be a slave. Here is that part.
Declared it to be unchristian, uncivilized, and immoral. But sensibilities in the world they knew were blunt, and relationships between masters and servants were commonly abrasive, at times savage. Though slavery, however defined, was degrading and brutal, in its various forms it was familiar, venerable, and as far as the planters knew, in principle, uncontested. It had existed in one form or another, defined in one way or another, for ages untold, and it flourished elsewhere in their own time, in the Middle East, in North and Sub-Saharan Africa, in Iberian America, and among native tribes. The question was not what the moral limits of slavery might be, but how it might best be elaborated and defined in law for maximum use in the Chesapeake, and how it might relate to differences in race. Answering these questions, even grasping their implications, was difficult, and successive efforts to reach a logical and complete resolution were halting and confused. By the 1660s and 1670s, the need for clarity in the legal status of blacks had become urgent, and laws and regulations of deepening confinement, incomplete and ambiguous though they were, followed in quick succession. One of the most important of the early laws, an epitome of the difficulties of definition, was adopted by Maryland in 1664. It was the first statute to recognize lifelong heritable slavery as a matter of law. But strangely, that was not its primary purpose. Confusing in its very title, an act concerning Negroes and other slaves, the latter unspecified. The law stated at the outset that all Negroes or other slaves already in the colony, or others who would come in the future, shall serve durante vita, or life, and their children will follow their father's status into the same condition. That profound assertion, which went to the heart of the matter, seemed obvious to the authors of the statute, and they disposed of it quickly, without elaboration, comment, or justification. What concerned them, and needed detailed comment and justification, was the question of miscegenation. What to do about the diverse, freeborn English women, who, forgetful of their free condition, and to the disgrace of our nation, do intermarry with Negro slaves? Conflicts had arisen touching the issue of such women, that threatened great damage to the slaves' masters. To prevent such shameful matches, the law stated that in the future white women who married blacks would become slaves of their husbands' masters as long as their husbands lived, and that their children would become slaves as their fathers were. As for the children of the white women who were presently married to Negroes, they were to serve their parents' masters till they be 30 years of age and no longer. By this statute, ambiguous and incomplete in its logic, slavery was declared to be lifelong servitude.
It's crazy to me how, you know, the phrase cuck became so big and how uncoincidental that is with what's going on and where it comes from historically.
Mm-hmm.
Like, fears of miscegenation and trying to stop it when it's like a natural thing because human beings are human beings that don't follow racialized categories. It's amazing how central those sorts of questions are always to questions like slavery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't. It was interesting reading this, coming right off of reading a bunch of Hawthorne for previous episodes, and I couldn't help but read it through Hawthorne's lens of objects and how objects transfer their meaning onto different things, and this
psychosomatic power that objects have that the owner doesn't necessarily even know where it comes from. It just can recognize the like aura of the object, like the Scarlet Letter, essentially. And you can see that played out in actual history, in American history, that it's easy, or I feel like it's understood that America was built on slavery, but it's Balin takes the idea to a higher complexity that not only was America built on slavery, but slavery was built on the American project, that chattel slavery wouldn't have been possible without the colonial experiment, essentially. So they reinforced each other, and it's in the DNA of this society. So when you have people like Ben Shapiro say certain things that are racially loaded, like sometimes they can make the argument that they don't even know what they're saying, that they're, right. They don't even really know, but they're just this inheritor of destruction and exploitation that, yes, they, at some level, he like obviously leans towards like, yeah, people in power should take advantage of people, of certain types of people. But then other things, when you see these like quote unquote slips, like sometimes I truly do believe like our conservative people in this country that are like, it was just a slip. Like, I didn't mean to be like racist.
Let's not monkey this up.
Exactly. But it's like, I kind of take him at his word sometimes, but like, that's just the world you live in. Like, you're so steeped in like, the race politics that this country was built. You don't even, I can understand how it would be an active choice.
That it's creating storms in your subconscious that you can't suppress, even when you're on national TV.
It's interesting. Like, you know, we live in Manhattan or, you know, in New York City. It's nice. None of us are from New York City. I'm from Texas. And it's just interesting going back home.
Oh, yeah.
And, some, you know, I lived there for 20 plus years before I left. But now when I go back, I just this, you know, sub-level of racism that doesn't matter your race. It's just sort of generally accepted. Like, that's just the generally accepted level of racism there. It doesn't matter your color. That's what everyone's operating based off of. And it's so different from here. And it's just, I'm like, man, this is racist. And I'm like, with some of my friends who might be black, but like, they're not upset about it. I'm like, you should be upset. Like, what just happened?
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, North Dakota is a bit different because there's not, well, yeah, I mean, the thing with North Dakota, and I think a lot of those sorts of states, like the Midwestern states, where they're like, they're getting, obviously there was always non-white people there, but like that the populations currently there are not used to diversity. That's why you're seeing the Mina Somalia, I feel like, the jokes that they make about the Somalians in Minneapolis. Like, they just not really equipped to handle it, and sort of, especially on the far right, the regular Fox News viewers, they're so keyed up to be defensive about it, right? Like,
well, if your media diet is any TV, but specifically Fox News, you have the oligarch class trying to scare the shit out of you.
Yeah, you're
any person of any color who's near you who's about to cut your fucking head off.
You're like a bird in the cage, and Fox News is just slamming the cage, just smashing the cage every day. And if you have family members that are Fox News viewers like I do, that's what's happening to them, and you should feel very angry about it.
But it's useful. It goes back. There was that James Baldwin quote. You know, it's very interesting. As you know, it's useful to divide the labor class, basically,
right? Oh yeah.
And it allows, you know, arguably Republicans to get away with a lot of their policies that disenfranchise them because they're using, you know, that race as a crutch,
right?
The people in that quote that are infuriated by this like racial miscegenation, like these people are the shock troops of like the hyper powerful that are like, we need to find a way to like inculcate these slaves into like this new society of like, this is the permanent labor class. And it's like, this intellectual intelligentsia has to get out there and like, and scare the shit out of people about this group of people who are new here. They're new and they're like, they're horrible human beings. And that's why we're going to treat them like shit and their offspring, essentially.
Can we pull up that quote with the anti-democracy bit? So they had this quote from John Cotton, who was a theologian in Massachusetts. Eager for the support and, if possible, the presence in New England of such distinguished figures, they assured their lordships that there was no danger that the colony would ever become a, quote, mere democracy. God, they hasten to say, never advise such a thing. Quote, if the people be governors, who shall be governed?
Yeah, and that's in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And that sort of thing is, I mean, that's going to show up in Scarlet Letter when Hester literally has to go to I don't think it's Winthrop's mansion. Maybe it is. Some mansion of a leader in the community to decide if her daughter is going to have to be put into give up for adoption, basically. And it's funny because, I mean, you basically go through a round of testing, a round of, you know, to make sure she's morally fit. And it's like the main leaders of the community doing it. It just seems, and even in the Scarlet Letter, it's like, you might think that they would have better things to do with their time, but not at this time. They're literally going to make the decisions about and micromanage the community.
It was interesting that that was how they were pitching it. Like, come on, elite people. Don't worry. We're not going to let the regular people run things here. Like, you guys will run this shit. Don't worry. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is... I bet there's a few books I just haven't got to that go into that. But that... The fear of that would be a very interesting thing, to fear of levelers.
There's definitely a push and pull, like, and you can see in the different colonies of this... Like, I guess it's almost like a... early idea of like a private public partnership that's going on.
Yep.
Like on the English model seems to have garnered more success of like, it's almost like constant check-ins with the parliament. Whereas like the Dutch program, like that ended up being a failure because maybe the Netherlands didn't pay close enough attention. Cause it was essentially just under like the, was it the Dutch East India Company's like purview entirely?
Yeah, we got a clip on that actually on Vanderdonk Donken on
named it which is he would later become Vander Donken Donuts. That's the one thing I underlined twice. Not even from Massachusetts, doesn't work.
In New Amsterdam's miniature theater of politics, 1649 was a crucial year of controversy between the determined, tough-minded director who had banned all subversive writings dangerous to the Republic, and the emboldened opposition, now dedicated not only to reducing the burdens they lived under, but to getting Stuyvesant.
So Stuyvesant was trying to stop fake news, and he had a resistance. That's what I'm getting.
Okay. Now dedicated not only to reducing the burdens they lived under, but to getting Stuyvesant removed from office. And more than that, the logic of the commonalty's demands revealed an inherent contradiction between the interests of the settlement's individual merchants and farmers and those of the absentee, profit-seeking company that governed them. What served the one disserved the other, or so it seemed, and the opposition drew the conclusion that the colony, no longer a mere trading outpost, but a society of permanent residents, would prosper only when freed of the company's control and brought under the direct jurisdiction of the Dutch government. Vanderdonk, having failed to win favor with Stuyvesant, threw himself into the project of ridding the colony not only of its unbudging director, but of the West India Company as well. Defiant of authority, convinced that his cause was a vindication of the rights and liberties defined by Europe's advanced thinkers, he took on the task of secretly compiling a list of particulars against Stuyvesant. Arrested and jailed when the director discovered the notes, which he denounced as slanderous, injurious, and defamatory, Vanderdonk then turned, in what must have been a passion of literary effort, to drafting three documents addressed to the illustrious high and mighty lords, States General, our most serene sovereigns. They were signed first by himself and Herman, then by nine others representing the commonalty. The first was a brief formal petition itemizing the causes of the very poor and most low conditions of the colony, and praying for relief from the unsuitable government of the West India Company and from the swarms of Schulte and Chinesen, Scots and Chinese, petty traders, who infest the land, while urging their high mightinesses to provide a municipal government for New Amsterdam, a sufficient population of good farmers, clear borders, and soldiers to protect them against the Indians.
So Vandedonk is seems like kind of cool, but also he has a bit of MAGA to him, I guess.
Yeah, kind
of. You're not taking care of strong enough borders. And what's with these Scots and Asians? This is pre-Celestials.
Well, yeah. This border issue is actually a real issue. Or, you know, I mean, it's an artificial constraint, but when you actually have, you know, natives that will kill you, you know.
Also, he came out against Keefe's War. We're getting really into Vonderdonk's personality.
That's what I want. I want to get, yeah, you're the Vonderdonkologist.
Yeah, I'm the most learned Vonderdonk stan currently in this room.
Scholar.
He got a chance to plead his case at The Hague for a proto form of a people's bill of rights, and he convinced them as well. But unfortunately, like the English Dutch War, they're like, well, we got to put a halt to it. But they were ready to bring Peter Stuyvesant. Eject him from the colony and bring him back to the Netherlands in place of, like, the colony would not be managed by the Dutch East India Company, but instead be managed by the Netherlands. But bad timing. But he made his case but under the understanding of, like, the colonists have human rights.
I think they go a little bit. Let's see here.
But other races do not have human rights in Vanderdonk's world, just so we're clear.
And Chinesen. Scots and Chinese, petty traders, who infest the land, while urging their high mightinesses to provide a municipal government for New Amsterdam, a sufficient population of good farmers, clear borders, and soldiers to protect them against the Indians. The second was a thick bundle of additional observations, documenting the claims of the petition in four main points with various subdivisions. The whole fortified by no fewer than 87 footnotes. The third, though in form an amendment to the petitions, was in effect a veritable treatise, a remonstrance of 83 pages, perhaps 25,000 words, that gave the petition monumentality. Vonderdonk began by presenting their high mightinesses with a bird's-eye view of the present condition of New Netherlands' fruitful and healthful land. Its history, people, flora, and fauna, and its ecology and contested boundaries. He then turned to an extended explanation of why and how New Netherland is so decayed. This was the heart of the matter, and he spared no details. There was no doubt, he wrote, as to why the colony was so decayed and in such ruinous condition. The cause was simple. Bad government, with its attendants and consequences. That was the true and only foundation stone of the decay and ruin of New Netherland. And the cause of the bad government? It was the profit-seeking, maladroit, neglectful, narrow-minded West India Company, still the owner and governor of the province. Both the company at home and its agents in the colony had, in their profiteering greed, virtually destroyed the colony. They had neglected to recruit a large enough population, while throwing money away on senseless extravagances. They had underfunded the public's needs while keeping the settlers from taking up profitable new land. They had increased taxes while charging high prices for necessary goods. They had denied the settlers their chartered rights while failing to protect them from the Indians. They had ignored the need for establishing firm boundaries with their neighbors. They had discouraged legitimate trade while winking at contraband commerce. They had, directly or indirectly, driven the Indians to war. And they had allowed the directors to exercise supreme authority equal to that of the Dutch government itself.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, basically, I guess we have a longer history of corporate ownership in this country than
especially
we do of
New
democracy.
York.
You know?
That's the point I always get annoyed about. Like, corporations are feudal era technology, right? Like, these things, you can't be a fucking, I mean, there a lot of the founding fathers were, obviously, so you definitely can be, but To me, if you're going to celebrate the best parts of the American Revolution, which are, if you look at it through a very like compressed way, is the anti-monarchy shit. It's corporations are just the agents of monarchy. And when you chop the head off the king, then you just create a lot of different headed
and all of
kings. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting when people talk about like the legacy of, you know, Western democracy and, you know, talk about Greece and stuff. When you talk about Greek and democracy, you're focusing on Athens, and people always forget like Sparta was oligarch. And so, you know, we have this twin, you know, it's like a twin legacy, you know, from Greeks.
Right.
You know, and yeah, I guess you've seen, you know, oligarchy predates democracy in this country, basically.
Well, and even there being like the Roman bros, as we were talking about earlier, like
now it's been solidified.
Rome's history like is varied in all of those sorts of things. It depends on where you jump in at, but oligarchy is a definite huge theme there. I mean, they probably wouldn't have had the critical sources we have today, but. And also, Rome was the first. Maybe not the first. I don't want to say that, but was a world civilization that simultaneously championed liberty while formalizing types of servitude. I don't know. It's a. Do you guys have any other comments you want to make on the book?
There's like discussion currently in New York of getting rid of certain Peter Stuyvesant monuments and like streets like Stuyvesant, because one thing we may have kind of glossed over that Stuyvesant was sent in to make the New Amsterdam colony profitable because it was not turning a profit yet, and it was troubling for the Dutch East India Company, and he finally was able to crack that nut, which is the slave trade. That the slave trade is what made that colony profitable, and he's like, once it started, he's like, oh, let's do this. And I can't, what's the pier that's now like it's like a music venue now?
Yeah, the South Street.
Yeah, I was like, what, Pier 23, some Pier 1.
Yeah. But for years, right, they made all the slaves had to go through the New York port there.
Yeah,
right?
That's the first major port. That's Peter Stuyvesant. So I would humbly suggest that if you're looking to change it, but you want to have some historical character with connections to New Amsterdam, Vanderdonk. That's all I'm saying. Not a perfect guy, but didn't start the slave trade.
Would you say you got more out of the heart of the world, or what's
Island called? At the heart of the world?
Yeah,
or some. Yeah, actually, I don't remember.
Like to me, I think this is a good book for a reference source, and it has a lot of good stories and illustration.
Yeah.
But I also thought like it did sort of it was hard for me to sort of grasp just because it seems a bit narrow. It seemed more narrow than what I thought I was buying. I will say that
where the book excelled was like snapshots.
Yes, exactly.
And this era is full of it. Like what Plokhoi, is that how you say his name?
Mm-hmm.
The whore kill colony where he's it was like proto communism. Essentially, where we should all be working essentially together, and something like a 6-hour work day, which I was like, all right, god damn it.
That was a really interesting vignette. Right?
Yeah, and especially in comparison to the Plymouth colony, because they were both these like millenarians, like we're going to start the world over, and his is like, we're going to do it through like cooperation with each other, and like, like the Plymouth colony is like, we're going to do it by ironing out all the bullshit in this world.
For the cry of them is exceeding great in these nations. And it was to that theme that he devoted himself in his next publication. The message of that remarkable treatise, a plan for an ideal Christian semi-communistic community that anticipated the later Delaware settlement, is entirely contained in its sprawling title, A Way Propounded to Make the Poor in These and Other Nations Happy by Bringing Together a Fit, Suitable, and Well-Qualified People into One Household Government or Little Commonwealth. Next,
what a ridiculous title!
You've got to get that title in here, though.
Like, why didn't someone advise him against that? He's like, no, I feel strongly in the title.
It's not going to make sense.
The thing about titles is, like, if you see a real long title from this time, it's because part of the reason is they would rip off the front cover and use it as like an advertisement. So you'd want as much detail in the title as possible.
No shit.
Like, Yeah, like, because he needs to do this, and he wanted to be saved by God, and he loved his wife. Like, you know, those sorts of titles? That all comes from that period of where you just, like, yeah, take it off and put it up as an ad.
Well, when the book is outlining him as, like, a proto-left-wing person, I was like, I always hate those distinctions, because it's like, well, they can't be proto-anything if they... It's like transplanting something that they have no knowledge of and putting it on them. But when they listed out the title of that book, I was like, oh, yeah, he's a lefty.
Makes sense.
All right, so this is about Peter Plokoy, the Dutch Mennonite who was a collegiate utopist who founded a settlement in 1663 near Horkill. That's Horekill, on the banks of Godin's Bay.
It may well have been that Cromwell was interested, but his death in September 1658 obstructed Plokoy in his proceeding, though only temporarily. 4 months later, the Dutchman laid out the same ideas in an extensive letter to Parliament, enclosing two letters he had written to Cromwell, all of which he published in a pamphlet entitled The Way to the Peace and Settlement of These Nations, aimed to awaken the public spirits in England. And he followed that production with yet another letter along the same line, addressed to the new Lord Protector, Richard Cromwell. Though by the spring of 1659 nothing had yet come of his efforts, Plokoy was only warming to the task of designing a utopian world. Social and economic ills were as much on his mind as religious oppression. He had ended his discourse to Parliament with the words, "Give ear to the poor, for the cry of them is exceeding great in these nations." And it was to that theme that he devoted himself in his next publication. The message of that remarkable treatise, a plan for an ideal Christian semi-communistic community that anticipated the later Delaware settlement, is entirely contained in its sprawling title, A Way Propounded to Make the Poor in These and Other Nations Happy by Bringing Together a Fit, Suitable, and Well-Qualified People into One Household Government or Little Commonwealth, wherein everyone may keep his propriety and be employed in some work or other, as he shall be fit, without being oppressed. Being the way not only to rid these and other nations from idle, evil, and disorderly persons, but also from all such as have sought and found out many inventions to live upon the labor of others. The title concluded with the words of the Psalms, Blessed is he that considereth the poor. He shall be blessed upon the earth.
So he was one of those guys that'd be like, come on, guys, what would Jesus do?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or yeah, today...
Jesus was actually a socialist.
Yes, and a lot of people be like, oh, you don't like a brown Muslim socialist? Well, then maybe you don't like Jesus. Which is definitely going to work on someone someday, I'm sure. Someone who's like, yeah, I'm a racist Christian. Like, oh, you just made me look like a fucking
idiot. 400 more years from now... That's going to kill.
Yeah. Yeah, man, you guys are about to look stupid.
Yeah, that is really where this book excels, and I think where this guy has, you can see where being at sort of a ivory tower of history, he's made full use of it. Of like, he has extremely good little illustrations for his points, and he knows, and he has an eye, and I think Taylor mentions this in the review derogatorily by saying it's like a fixation on weirdness, but he does have an eye for the quirky character that sort of embodies a lot of different interesting flows of belief and culture.
Yeah, and I think when you were saying that it's hard to find a cohesive whole, it's almost by design that works well for the book, considering or looking at America in like 2018. Like, that could just be like the internal contradiction of the American experiment, which is all these disparate elements coming in to make their one America, and they at some point have to find a way to like all live together, and they often don't. They often result in into violent conflict. Right. Like, that just seems like you could just describe colonial America like current America. It's just a current state of factions fighting it out, but all being like, yeah, we're one country, or we'll someday. It's like an idea that never happens, I guess.
Yeah. Well, guys, I think that should about do it for The Barbarous Years by Bernard Bailyn. This is a good one. Thank you guys for joining me in the Majority Report studios, actually. Don't tell Sam.
yeah, don't broadcast this.
Don't tweet at him about this. No, he just he knows. So thanks again for joining us. And I'll put the information. Anything you guys want to plug? Do you want to specifically plug your Twitter accounts, or should I just put them in the comments?
The only thing I want to plug is I made a mistake earlier. So I plug up a leak, which is I attributed a quote to Locke, and I remember it's Hobbes. So before anyone tries to go after
the
me.
The nasty Brutus in short.
Yeah, it's the state of nature. I thought about it halfway through, and I was like, I'll literally kill myself if I don't fix this. So don't worry, I'm actually smart.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is, if we did a slightly more frequent podcast, patreon.com/literaryhangover, we could be more... Like, now I'm more... you have to, because you aren't going to get a chance to really double back to previous episodes. Hey, by the way, I effed that up a little bit. Like, yeah. I do not know where I heard that Hawthorne, I said it was Hawthorne, hated the bank. I haven't been able to find that again. And it's bothering the shit out of me. And so I don't know. Am I going to go erase that from the podcast, or am I just going to consider this as apology enough right now? That's what I'm going to do. That's why I...
Well, it's also like, do I want to make this correction? Because then I'm now open to
that responsible to correct.
Yeah, like, I know I've made easily 1,000,000 mistakes.
Oh no, I want
the last seven episodes. Those don't correct me on. I don't need to know.
No, I want to know because that's an episode produced itself.
Right.
Just do this is our grab bag omnibus corrections episode.
Yeah, don't at me when just at Matt basically.
Yeah, at Literary Hangover, at Lit Hangover. Because look, like we said last time, we're not PhDs in any of this shit. So if you are, you know, give us a break and
donate.
Just correct us. But thank you guys. We will see you in 2 weeks.